It's the True Penny Show at the G1.
Hello and welcome to the True Penny Show. My name is James True Penny. This is my show, and we're back with the G1 Climax coverage of 2018, the 28th tournament. And today we're looking at nights 14 and 15 to catch us up to the final run at Budokan Hall, back at Budokan for the G1 Climax final. And to join me today is Miss Mo Chatterer. Thank you very much for joining me.
Glad to be back on. Yeah, it just seems like 5 minutes since it was last time.
It's been a bit of a busy couple of weeks doing this. It's always fun to do the G1, and it's fun to have different people on and to join the family. And it's been nice having you, sir.
No, I've really enjoyed it. It's good to talk G1. I've been, as you know, following the G1 for many, many years. And I think it's the first time I've actually podcasted on them. So, really, really enjoyed it.
How have you felt this has measured up to other G1s down the years? Because we've been doing this. This is our third year of doing it, like, as a full tournament. So, and I had watched others, but not, like, as in-depth as I have been for this. What's your impressions? What's the 28th G1, how's it measure up to the other 28 that you've seen? I'm not sure you've seen all 28, but how does it measure up to the ones you have seen?
Yeah, I mean, so I think I first started watching in 94, and I had watched the odd one or two matches, like especially the finals, on tape from the early ones. But certainly from about 94 onwards is when I was keeping up with pretty much everything that was going on, even though not every match was necessarily televised from memory. But I mean, this is going back quite a while. But yeah, I mean, as you know, I became a Power Slam writer in the late 90s, but I started reading the magazine and even its predecessor, Superstars of Wrestling, pretty much since they launched. And you know, they got me even more interested in Japanese wrestling than I was when I was reading the Aptamags, which happened even earlier in the 90s. So I've followed the vast majority of the G1s, and in answer to your question, this is gearing up to be the best ever. I mean I'm a bit of a geek when it comes to things like star ratings, and I've been rating all of the matches through the tournament, and I think the most 4-star ratings plus I've given for any tournament was, I think, 2016, when I awarded 37 matches 4-star or better. As of night 15, I'm up to 31, so we're only 7 off, and we've still got the 3 biggest nights of the tournament to come, so it looks like we're going to exceed 2016 as the best one for me. I mean, there are others that still stand out in the memory. So 96 because of Choshu. 98 was a really fun one because Tenryu and Hashimoto really lit up that tournament. It had some dour years in the early noughties and then started picking up again in the mid-noughties when Akiyama was turning up to help prop up the tournament. And then the younger talent started to kind of really come through, the Tanahashis, Nakamura's, and then, you know, the late noughties. And for pretty much the last decade or so, it's been a really fun tournament. But the last 3 to 4 years, it's just gone to another level entirely. And this year, thus far, is gearing up to be the best one ever.
Yeah, I mean, I had a similar path of understanding Japanese wrestling as you, because I started reading about it in Power Slam. That's where most of my knowledge came from originally. And Finn Martin's writing about Japanese wrestling was the thing that really inspired me to be a Japanese wrestling fan, more so than I had been before. I knew a bit because of Dynamite Kid and him being my hero and, you know, all those things. And then I found out more about the Dynamite Kid, and he wasn't so much of a hero anymore, but he's still one of my favorite wrestlers. But, you know, the actual kind of growth, I think we probably have a very similar kind of growth in Japanese wrestling, and when we're doing the beginner's guide to Japan, we've noticed this as well. Like, we're getting to 95 now, and it's getting harder to find full and complete shows to review. Like, we've been doing like full shows, and it gets harder after 95 because that's when the Japanese wrestling business drops off. You know, not so much 95, but that run from like 99 to around about, where just as the economy crashed through the floor to around about 2010, it's getting harder for us to find reviews. Not that we will stop the beginner's guide, because we love doing the beginner's guide, but you know what I mean.
Mm. Yeah, no, I mean, you know, the Japanese 90s golden era was just immense. And, you know, fortunately, I discovered tape traders in about 1993, and I was able to obtain quite a lot of tapes in 93 through till 96. And then I was fortunate enough to find a guy in the United States called Bob Barnett, who was a tape trader out in California, who was just the most, he's still around, by the way, and he's just the most amazing guy. Every time I phone him, he would regale me with tales of his latest exploits in the bedroom, which were utterly fascinating. And in between that, he was also moonlighting as Vampiro's attorney. And as I understand it, he needed to have a full-time attorney based on some of the stuff he was getting up to in Mexico. But also, Bob was a tape trader, and you know, he was the person that was producing these Best of Japan tapes. So if any of you were around back then picking up these Best of Japan tapes from the likes of Rob Butcher or Glenn Radford, the tapes were emanating from Bob. And so I was going direct to the source, and from about 96 onwards was obtaining these tapes from him. And he would also share some other stuff that didn't make the cut, didn't make those tapes. And you know, the stuff he was receiving was really, really, really good. And those tapes were invariably amazing, because that was such a golden era. But as you say, as we got to the tail end of the 90s, a lot of those guys were starting to break down physically because of the immensely physical style that they had to work. Then there was that drop off, and you know, Pro Wrestling Noah then came along, you know, in 2001 and really hit its stride in 2003, right through to about 2008-09. But New Japan really, really was in the doldrums for quite a considerable period of time, really until around the late noughties, so 2007-08, maybe a bit later than that, when it became consistently really good. And it's only in the last 5 or 6 years that it's just become the number one wrestling promotion in the world for match quality by some distance. But yeah, that's the potted history of, you know, Japanese wrestling in terms of coverage. And as you say, you know, it was difficult to get certain reviews of stuff because so many of the fans that loved it in the golden era of the early to mid 90s really fell out of it as the decade wore on, and match quality really in certain areas fell off a cliff.
Yeah, definitely. We should do a show on tape trading one day, just because like the guy I got stuff from was Dean Ayers, who is the IPW color commentator now and a former manager of the British wrestling scene, and he's done everything, and was moaning to EE at the weekend on Twitter about the fact that he wasn't using a contract because he thought it was unfair as an Ipswich fan that they used Delia Smith as their new advertising campaign with Kevin Bacon. So, and Dean's awesome. And he managed Terry Funk once, as he will tell you many times.
Oh, you've never mentioned that before.
Yeah.
Dean and I go back so many years. And he's just an amazing person. He's a really, really lovely guy. And, you know, he's added so much to the business in the UK over, well, 25 years now. So, you know, he's still around, still doing his thing, still contributing. And, you know, a very funny guy to boot. So, yeah, I can't say enough good things about the guy.
Very cool dude indeed. Right then, we should get back to our job, which is to review Night 14, which I will say is one of the best cards of wrestling I've seen in the last 10 years, just in the tournament matches. I didn't bother with the tag matches. Like I've been saying, we don't have time to cover the tag matches, and I'm a bit pressed for time this week, so I didn't bother with the tag matches. But just the last five matches were outstanding, and I loved them, all of them. But we'll get to the specific ones I loved more than others. The opening match was Sanada versus Toriano, which is everything I want ever from a Toriano match. It had the lot, and it only lasted in 5 minutes and 22 seconds. Toro jumped Sanada from the get-go. He's given up on fair play. He knew he was going to win trying to do it straight. So he cheated from the beginning till the very end of the match and paid for it in a big way by being paradise locked and taped to the guardrail. Rocky out to save him. He was paradise locked, and then Milano Collection 80 had to come and undo them all. And Sanada won in 5 minutes and 22 seconds, and it was brilliant. What did you think of this, Mo?
it was goodness. Yeah, I mean, Yano is, you know, such a unique character and adds so much to the G1. I mean, he's not there for working five-star matches. He's there to do something different, offer something that the others don't. And, you know, even by his standards, you know, this was immensely fun. You know, it was a short match, and you weren't going to get a great match with loads of great, amazing near falls. This is not what this was about. This was about pure unadulterated comedy, and, you know, he brought something original here. And, you know, some of those spots where he initially tried to get the count out win with tape didn't quite work, nearly but not quite, and then in the end got a taste of his own medicine, and that cost him, and he lost out with the count out victory. And you know, made Sanada, who's a bit stoic and a bit serious, quite a funny character almost, and brought almost a different side out of him, which isn't easy to do. So yeah, all things considered, by Yano standards, this was a lot of fun.
If Sanada's been in Chikara, Raider Volador, so there you go, that's the one. So he's kind of down with this stuff, and it kind of matches his stoic character, because he can pull off the funny stuff and keep a dead straight face all the time. I don't know how he does it, but yeah, it works really, really well. The next match was Hiroki Goto versus Dharma Tonga. He defeated Dharma Tonga by DQ in 11 minutes and 15 seconds in what was a perfectly good match up until the ending, when it was kind of into the Bullet Club interference. And I kind of, last time you were on, we talked about how this was starting to grind, and now it's starting to grind on me because it's getting a bit too obvious. Dharma Tonga this week has been apparently fined by New Japan Pro Wrestling, and they didn't put the fine in until he dropped litter in a railway station, in a bullet train station, apparently offending veterans of the United States military is fine, but you can't drop litter in a bullet train station. That's when they brought the social media fines into play for Dharma Tonga, which I find hilarious. But there you go, Hiroki Goto on 6 points, Dharma Tonga on four. Kind of like this a lot. Dharma Tonga and Goto kind of have evasive style, which matches well together, and I like this. 11 minutes and 15 seconds. What did you think, Mo?
Yeah, I thought it was building up to quite a nice match, and I thought, okay, please just do something different for once. I mean, you know, we're 15 nights into this, and if it's not Dharma Tonga by DQ with a loss, then it's bad luck Fale. But no, they stuck true to form, and it was yet another DQ. But up until then, you know, I thought it was building quite well, and you know, I was actually quite enjoying it. But no, it wasn't to be. Yet another DQ. But you're right about the fine thing. That just seems a bit bizarre, and, you know, a bit Japan. So, it's possibly linked to the whole stuff with Roman Reigns as well. Maybe they think he's going a bit too far with some of that. I don't know. But, you know, he's certainly entertaining in certain ways, but when it comes to match quality, perhaps less so compared to others in this tournament.
I do wonder, because I don't think it's like they have a social media officer. Like, most big companies have a social media officer. WWE, about 50, to make sure that everybody is towing the company line, or at least not doing anything stupid. And in this particular case, with Tama, he's trying to evolve his heel character, and he's trying to figure out where the line is, I guess, and then perhaps he has passed it a bit too much. I don't necessarily mind the stuff with Roman Reigns, because it's put an awful lot of highlight onto him in the social media world. So I think that probably would have been all right in my book. I think it's probably more to do with the stuff with the veterans and things like that, which I think was probably a bit over the line, to be fair. But yep. Certainly... you know, not as bad as some of the things that have happened in wrestling this week, which I'm sure we'll talk about at some point.
It's been another crazy week, as it always is. I mean, there's barely a week that can go by without somebody dropping the bollock and, you know, coming out with utter nonsense. But he was hardly the worst defender this week, that's for sure.
Definitely not. And Rev Pro, good on you for standing up and doing the right thing. I will say that. eventually. Yeah. Sam Adonis, not so much. Anyway, the next match, Zack Sabre Jr. defeats Juice Robinson in 13 minutes and 39 seconds. And I have to say this was the best match I've seen Juice Robinson in this tournament, and possibly the best match, or the match I enjoyed most. Not necessarily the best match. That one with Jay White at G1 Special was pretty good. But this one with Zack was excellent. It matched their two styles perfectly. Juice kind of with that bit ragged at the minute because of the broken hand. He's really selling that. It was telling the story, and he was the ideal opponent for Zack Sabre Jr. To really gut-wrench the emotion out of this match, and it was thoroughly enjoyable to watch. You know, as much as watching Zack destroy a human being piece by piece can be enjoyable. I guess I like that kind of thing. But it was really, really good. And yeah, kudos to both guys, and it looks like Zack Sabre Jr. is going to be Juice Robinson's foil for the next couple of months. What did you think of this, Mo?
Oh yeah, it was so much fun. Zack just gets more insane with all of his counters. you just think there's no way on earth that he can come up with a counter that leads to a submission from that spot, and yet somehow he manages it. And it's just almost a sign of genius that he can come up with some of the stuff he does. Because I mean, I've been watching wrestling for more years than I care to mention, and you know, he does stuff that I've never seen. And, you know, I've watched plenty of Zack over most of his career. And, you know, even, you know, during this tournament, I've seen him do stuff that, you know, I don't recall him having done before. So, you know, he really is such a clever guy, and is always thinking, and thinking on the fly as well, because the style he works, you know, there needs to be some degree of spontaneity as well to be able to react. I mean, yeah. Even if it's a botch spot, you know, just to react to it very quickly and make it look like it was all planned and turn it into some kind of submission maneuver or a counter. You know, that's something that a lot of guys or girls in the business just can't do. But he's the master at it. And, you know, this was yet another example of it. And, you know, I mean, I do feel that Juice has had one or two better matches in this, but certainly this for me was top three and just a really, really good match.
I mean, I think the thing is for me, if you had said like 10 years ago, there's a guy, he's going to wrestle a bit like Jim Breaks and a bit like Johnny Saint, and he's going to be 185 pounds and he's going to win the J Cup, no one would have said that, would they? No.
Even if you mentioned it to me 18 months, 2 years ago, I still wouldn't believe that New Japan would use Zack in the way that they have, and that he would be as effective and as much of an important integral player as he has become. But somehow they've managed it. And in fairness, it's more down to him. He's such a talented worker, and you know, he just can work with people of a variety of styles, whether it's brawlers, the high flyers, other technical guys. You know, he just knows how to adapt his style that can work with them and still make it almost be his kind of match.
Yeah.
No matter who the opponent is. And there are very, very few guys in this business and girls that can do that, that can make any type of opponent work their style and still make it entertaining and believable. And you know, he's one of the very, very few, so therefore he is one of the elite workers in the business.
I mean, Shona Baszler in NXT, I think, is probably the only other person that kind of comes close, who's got that catch-as-catch-can style background to be able to, I mean, she doesn't run the rope, she's very straight ahead in her wrestling style, can you imagine 10 years ago saying there's going to be a female wrestler in WWE that doesn't run the ropes and she's going to be a superstar, you know?
Oh.
And it's like this style of wrestling, it's been popularized out of MMA really, I guess, but also Zack has kind of like adopted the old world of sports style, which again came from catch wrestling in the 30s and 40s. So, you know, it's all kind of linked into that same family and style of wrestling. And it's a joy to watch. I love watching it basically just because it's so safe. You know, they're not taking massive risks and they're still having exciting matches, and their careers are going to be longer according to the less bumps they have to take, the less impacts they have to deal with. You know, Zack obviously has to take up like a lot of strikes from guys like Goto and Ishii on a frame that's really not meant to do that, but equally it's still a lot safer than, say, no no knock on Kota Ibushi style, but you know what I mean? It's a lot safer than that style.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, you have to look at Will Ospreay as well. And, you know, just have to listen to some of what he's talked about in the last year, 18 months, about some of the injuries he's had to deal with. You know, it's not something that you can sustain for a prolonged period. And now at a certain point, Will get to the point where he has to adapt his style and become safer. And, you know, you look at Rey Mysterio, he had to do the same as well.
Yeah.
You know, he was, you know, really suffering with his knee injuries over a prolonged period, and he had to adapt, and that's why he can still go now. And, you know, he still pulls out the high spots, but, you know, certainly far more limited than they used to be going back 15, 20, 25 years ago. And, you know, we'll have to do the same. Whereas somebody like Zach, you can see him working exactly the same style just as effectively 10 years from now, because, you know, physically just shouldn't be taking a toll on you, that the more high-flying style with, you know, the harder-hitting bumps will do. You know, these guys are human, let's not forget. I mean, we can get a bit desensitized to the whole thing, and, you know, but the thing with that happened with Hiromu the other week really brought it home, you know, that just a slight, you know, 1 or 2 inch here or there can make all the difference. And, you know, you just have to hope that these guys stay safe when they work these more high-risk matches.
I mean, Johnny Saint was, I think he was 72 when he made his ECW arena debut for Chikara at King of Trios, and wasn't that off the pace wrestling guys like Daniel Bryan. Obviously,
absolutely.
For a 72-year-old, he was pretty damn good overall. So, yeah, you can work this style and make it work for you. Right then, the next match was Tomohiro Ishii defeating the undefeatable in Kenny Omega, who's been on fire in this tournament. 22 minutes and 42 seconds in my match of the tournament. I have to say, this was my favorite. This was started off a bit shaky. It was full court press from Kenny Omega. He knew he had to put Ishii away, but he just couldn't do it. And when Ishii saw his opportunity, he took the win, and that was the story. And it was such a good match. It was so well laid out. With Ishii, when he's got nothing to lose, he's the most dangerous man in the company. That's his character. And here he proved it. He can beat the champ anytime he wants to, as long as he's got his back to the wall. And the only thing he was fighting for was a shot at that IWGP Heavyweight Championship. And I get a feeling he might get his chance at King of Pro Wrestling. What did you think, Mo?
Wow. this was just incredible. And we've seen some amazing matches in this tournament. But I agree with you. This was this is the best match I've seen in the tournament thus far, and one of the best few matches I've ever seen, in fact. I'd go so far as to say that. It was just an absolute roller coaster, a tour de force of emotion, of finesse, back and forth. You really couldn't tell which way it would go, but you had the feel that, you know, Ishii just taking it to another level entirely here, and you know, perhaps knowing that he was going to get this big win over the IWGP champion, you know, spurred him on to put in even more effort than he normally puts in. And he puts in greater effort than most in the business. It was fantastic. I mean, there were, for those that love to nitpick, you know, there were a couple of shaky spots. I think he lost him almost on a powerbomb. There was another spot. And if you're really nitpicking, Omega was out. Well, one shoulder was up on the third count. But my justification for that was, well, actually, it was on the blind side of the referee, so it's okay. But, you know, you'd have to be extremely, extremely harsh to be judging those few little things against the overall quality of the match, because it was just amazing. And anybody that thinks it wasn't, maybe just needs to go find something else to get interested in. Because if this doesn't rock your boat, then nothing will.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing is the shoulder up at the end gives Kenny an out, doesn't it? Let's be honest as well. It was accidental purely. It was only because Tomohiro was trying to drag him over as far as he possibly could. And he just lifted his shoulder at the end. And it's like, yeah, you can get away with that. I'm not going to argue with that one. I was all right. You know, this match... Yeah, as far as like match of the year contenders, it's pretty up there. I mean, my match of the year is Kaylee Ray versus Meika Satomura from Wrestle Queendom, which I was there for in person, and was just my favorite European wrestler versus my favorite wrestler, and they tore the house down. They were absolutely outstanding, and it was one of those magic moment matches. And this is kind of the similar kind of thing, you know. It's like Kaylee Ray going into that match, she wins that match, and she just put everything she possibly could into that match, and Meika Satomura is Meika Satomura, so it's going to be awesome. And this is the same thing, you know. Tomohiro just had to put the effort in, and Kenny would do the rest, and that's what happened. It was so, so good. My other kind of match of the year is obviously Kenny versus Okada, the best of three falls match, but this one is up there just because it's a different kind of story. You kind of expected Kenny to win that best of three falls match. The pointers were all there, whereas this one kind of comes out of nowhere because you're expecting Omega to go to the end of the run undefeated as the champion. That's kind of the story they've been telling. So I think this is, I'm not saying it's better than the Okada Omega one, it's just different.
It is. I mean, there are those that find long matches, and you know, Omega Okada was very long, quite difficult to sit through and concentrate, you know, for that period of time. Whereas, you know, no such problem with this. I mean, it was just over 20 minutes, but it flew by. It was fought at just a frenetic pace, and it was just an immense, immense match. And now, you have to give credit to Omega as well, because, you know, you look at his work over the last 2 months, the Okada match in June, and then he's had, you know, three matches in this tournament that have been absolutely fantastic, and several others that have been really, really good as well. And I think, oh God, who did you wrestle at the G1 special in
Saturday? Cody.
Oh, that was Cody. Okay, let's forget about that one.
That was a different kind of match, wasn't it? That was to tell the story of Bullet Club. It didn't have to be, it had to be good, but it didn't have to be like amazing.
No, that's right. Yeah, I mean that was certainly more of a storyline type match. But yeah, I mean he has had, you know, four matches in the last 2 months that are amongst the best matches I've ever seen, and you know there are a lot of people that like to give Kenny and his work hard time and feel that, you know, it's a bit too high spot orientated, but you know, he knows how to have dramatic matches, and he's so, so good. He really is, and he's just taken it to a whole different level this year, and I just admire his work so much. You know, for him to be able to do what he did in 2017 and somehow arguably top it this year is just incredible.
Yeah, I mean, the thing you have to think about Kenny Omega is the amount of pressure there is on him to be good. And he can't phone it in. He has to be that good every championship match, just because Okada had the best run of anyone ever in wrestling for 2 years. And you've got to live up to that. You know, the pressure on Kenny Omega to perform is immense, and he's doing such a good job with that. You know, aside from trying to keep free from injury and have the best match on the card and lead the company and all the things Okada did, and he has to do that and be as good as, or if not better than, Kazuchika Okada, which is a hard ask for any wrestler, really.
Oh, it is. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think he handles it really well. And, you know, he has his critics out there, Jim Cornette and, you know, one or two other dinosaurs, but you know, he kind of brushes it aside and manages it, you know, with humour and humility. And you know, he's a really good talent. And you know, I tell you what, my favourite title reign ever up until the Okada one was the Kobashi one for the JC title in 2003-05, and I thought, good luck anybody ever topping that range for match quality, and yet Okada did.
Yeah,
and I think, you know, if anybody can come close to that, it is Kenny Omega. And I don't think he's going to go 2 years with the title. I would imagine that he will drop it in the next 6 to 9 months. But certainly whilst he's involved in that title picture, you know, everything he will do will be gold. I'm absolutely sure of that, because, as you say, there is that expectation on him, not least the pressure he puts on himself to deliver and to exceed what he's already done. He's not somebody who gets into routine and just sticks by it, which, you know, some greats of the past were accused of. No, he looks for different ways to evolve his work, and he clearly thinks about doing things slightly differently and adding more and more to it. And you know, that's why I enjoy watching him.
Yeah, I mean, he's brought in the DDT. He's brought in a few other new things to this tournament, because, like we said before, there's a lot of matches that are all very high quality, so you have to do different things. You just can't pull out the same stuff. You know, Ishii as well here, having a crack at the One Winged Angel and pulling off some of Kenny's moves, which is kind of a key thing he does to guys that he knows he's going to have a big match with. He tends to pull out their moves and show them, I can just do things just as well as you. So yeah, it was very, very good. Right then, the next match. Actually, well, we should probably just talk about points here, because if Kenny had won that match, he would have won the block, but he didn't, which meant the next match suddenly had an awful lot more to play for. Kota Ibushi, who has yet to wrestle Kenny Omega, and that's the tiebreaker. If they all end up tied on points, it means the person that has wins over your other person. So if you've got like Kota Ibushi and Kenny Omega at the end and Kota wins, that's the tiebreaker. So Kota has yet to wrestle Kenny. That's the next match for him. Tetsuya Naito has already lost to Kenny. So Tetsuya Naito needed to win this match to get to 12 points to stand a chance of winning the tournament, and he didn't. Kota won here in 25 minutes and 9 seconds. Now, this may have been the most difficult position to go into the G1 from a performer's point of view, because they're sat in the back watching Tomohiro Ishii knock Kenny Omega's head off for 20 minutes. This was hard ask to come out and do, but the Osaka crowd were really up for it. They hate Tetsuya Naito with a passion, possibly the only fans left in Japan who do. And Kota Ibushi is the golden star. He's the golden boy at the minute in New Japan Pro Wrestling. And they put on a bit of a classic. It wasn't as good, I don't think, as Kenny and Tomohiro, but it was a damn fine match. And it kind of like was slightly spoiled because they've gone after such a great match. However, Kota Ibushi does take the win, and they were doing some impressive, impressive stuff. What do you think of this, Mo?
Well, again, this was a fantastic match. It wasn't at the level of the match that preceded it, obviously, but you know, given the circumstances of having to follow a contest where the fans just expended so much energy and emotion into what preceded it, for them to get the crowd up in the way they did, certainly towards the end of this contest, was really a credit to Naito and Ibushi for the talents that they are. And, you know, on most other G1 nights, and certainly in previous years, this would easily have been a match of the night. But, you know, this had to play distant second. I mean, I had this, you know, for those star rating geeks, at 4.5 stars.
Mm.
And, you know, that's, you know, for those that don't know star ratings or don't really care too much about them, that's me saying this was a heck of a match. This really was a very, very, very good contest. You know, we know what we get with Naito and Ibushi. They are preeminent workers. You know, they were given a reasonable time slot. You know, they were given more time than the previous contest. And, you know, they, again, worked it in a smart way. You know, they had to bring the crowd down a little, which would be expected. But then they built it back up in the middle, and, you know, the final stretch, you know, was very exciting. And, you know, we had a great near fall. I think we had a Destino leading to a near fall. And then, obviously, Ibushi countering and finishing it with a Kamigoye. So that was just so sweet. And it made it absolutely intriguing at the top, because if Ibushi beats Omega, he goes to 12. And if Naito wins his final one, then we've got a three-way tie at the top for 12 points.
Who's Naito's final match? Can you remember?
Oh, that's a good question.
Juice? Or Tama? No, they had Tama. He wrestled Tama. He's wrestled Taru.
He's got two matches left, hasn't he?
Oh, yeah, maybe so. Okay.
Sabre. Zack Sabre Jr. and Sonata.
Right, yeah, because Sonata will be the final match, won't it? So, Yeah, that'll be really interesting as well, because obviously LIJ member versus LIJ member. Will Sonada do the favors?
Oh, and actually, Omega's got Yano as well as Ibushi. And Ibushi has, in addition to Omega, Tama Tonga.
There's a load of spoilers in there. There's a load of people that traditionally screw things up for other people. Toru Yano's biggest job in the G1 is screwing things up for Minoru Suzuki, and he's not in the same block this year, so he's got to screw something up for somebody else.
Yeah, absolutely. So, he's possibly still got a role to play here. But, it's intriguingly gearing up for the final night of Block B. And, two more nights to go, nights 16 and 18 for Block B. If Omega gets a win over Yano, then he's certainly very, very well placed to go on and win it. But then, if Ibushi gets his win over Tonga, he goes up to 12, and if he beats Omega on the final night, then he can tie Omega at 14. And then, Naito, he perhaps seems like the outsider of the three at this stage. He has to get wins over Sabre and Sonata just to potentially go level with Omega if he wins one of his final two contests. So, you think it would be Omega, but, I'd actually really like Ibushi to get through to the final. It'd be something different. And I don't like to see the world champion in the G1 fight. Well, I mentioned it last time. I don't like to see the champion in the tournament at all. So certainly wouldn't want to see them in the final. I think the loss to Ibushi would certainly, from a storyline perspective, set things up quite nicely for the months ahead.
I did say on the Total Writers Wrestling podcast last week, which you can hear on their feed, with Mike Freeland, and an interview with Jerry Lynn, which is very cool and very informative. And Jerry gives an awful lot of good stories, so you should have a listen to that. I was asked, and Mike put me on the spot, and I said, I kind of think Naito will win this block because of the politics of the Wrestle Kingdom main event. I think it's either got to be, obviously Omega's probably going to be there, and you've got to say it's got to be Naito and Okada because they've got to make money. But it also depends on what Chris Jericho is doing next January, and there's various other factors that could come into play before then. And of course, whoever wins the G1, they defend their championship slot, so there is a possibility that it might not be whoever wins the G1 is in the main event. So we'll see, but I'm thinking Naito might be my favourite at the moment to win this block and maybe win the tournament. Depends on what they're doing with Okada. Has Okada been down enough to have his redemption story told yet? Probably not. And Naito is due because he's had a bit of a bad run. So I'm kind of saying Naito. But again, I would agree with you. If it was Ibushi, and Ibushi versus Omega at Wrestle Kingdom would be outstanding. But I'm not sure if they'd have a big enough undercard to carry that as a main event yet. Whereas Omega versus Naito or Omega versus Okada does sell the Wrestle Kingdom main event. So we'll see, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. And also with the tournament itself, one thing we haven't had yet is a 30-minute draw.
No,
and,
true.
So say if Omega suffers a surprise loss to Yano, perhaps by countout or something, and then a draw to Ibushi on the final night of Block B, then he finishes on 13 points. And meanwhile, Naito can sneak up and with two wins get up to 14 and therefore go to the final. So, there's so much possibilities, and that's part of the beauty of the way that Gedo books the tournament. He leaves things open, and there are various permutations that can be seen, right up until the final night. So, he does make it interesting.
Yeah.
To him as a booker.
I mean, Alex Edwards was saying last show that, he's seen like one block. The last couple of years, they've had one block where you've got a clear cut guy they're pushing, and then the other block has been three or four guys, and they've done it differently this year because as we're looking at block A in a second, there's three or four guys or three guys who can win that as well. So it's been interesting that they've kind of built the tension in both blocks rather than just the one.
It's getting tight at the top on both blocks again. Nobody's running away with it, even though obviously Omega up until night 14 seemed like he was on the cusp of getting it wrapped up and able to put his feet up with one or two matches to go, but not quite the case.
No. Right then, we will move on to night 15, which was a Block A night. Yoshihashi defeats Bad Luck Fale in 8 minutes and 31 seconds in another interference fest, which was all right for what it was. Poor Yoshi. Getting his ass whooped by all of Bullet Club. What I did like was them dragging Red Shoes out and him just flipping the bird at them when they asked him to count the... It's like, yeah, you go, Red Shoes. Yeah. It was all right. So, yeah, that was okay. But it was kind of a nothing match, but it did kind of give Yoshihashi 2 points, and I think he deserved 2 points after getting kicked in for that. So, yeah. What do you think, Mo?
Yeah, I mean, a bit of deja vu from the night before. With obviously yet another DQ, this time involving Fale. Yoshihashi, I thought, was getting a good match out of Fale up until the DQ. But you know, we're 16 nights into the tournament, sorry, 15 nights into the tournament, and, you know, nightly DQs by this point feel almost uninspiring and unimaginative. And, you know, it just feels like complete overkill by this stage. So, you know, there were certain fans that just absolutely shit over this contest from a great height online because, you know, they're just so fed up of seeing the same finishes night after night with Fale and Tonga. And, you know, I can understand it, but up until that finish itself, I thought it was building up to a decent contest. And as you say, the Red Shoes spot was pretty cool, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, it kind of tells the story all around. I've got a feeling there'll be a payoff in the last couple of days. By the time they get to Budokan, there's got to be a payoff to this. Possibly, I can't remember who Bad Luck Fale or Tama Tonga's wrestling on the last day, but if it's somebody from Chaos, I get a feeling, or Suzuki Gun, that the army might come down. And they'll get their comeuppance, I would hope, anyway. Next match was
Suzuki. Minoru Suzuki, final opponent for Fale.
Minoru Suzuki, eh? Yeah, try doing that to him and see how well you get on. Anyway, the next match was Hangman Page defeating, indeed, said the back veil, Minoru Suzuki in 12 minutes and 5 seconds. This was really, really good. I get the feeling Mr. Suzuki has a bit of respect for Hangman Page because he showed him an awful lot of respect in this match in his way of spitting on him and hitting him really hard. But it was a lot of fun to watch. Hangman Page, can't say enough about him in this tournament. 6 points, which for a first performance is really, really good. And he's been awesome. And playing the full-on babyface here, started off with a moonsault off the rampway and it went on from there. And it was a bit wild and a bit woolly, but I thoroughly enjoyed it. What did you think of this, Mo?
Yeah, likewise. You know, I've got to say that even though Jay White is a guy that, you know, he's getting a bigger push in this tournament, I've personally preferred the work of Page. I think that he's shown a bit more in terms of technically with his in-ring, but also personality-wise as well. He's showed a little bit more, emoted more than White has. As the tournament's gone on, White seemed to go into shell a bit more, and maybe because he's naturally introverted, he kind of struggles to come across in that kind of more authentic way, whereas for me, Page does. And I was a bit unsure about how much Suzuki would give him. You know, Suzuki, if he was so inclined, could have actually given him very little before ultimately putting him over in a bit of a Scott Hall with Lucha Libre wrestlers in Nitro days type of thing, but no, that wasn't the case. He actually you know, allowed him, if that's the right word, you know, a decent amount of offense, and you know, for various passages of the contest, made him come across as an equal almost. And you know, for a 25-year-old kid, you know, that was quite an encouraging nod by Suzuki in the direction of Page. So if I was Page, I'd actually be quite pleased that master veteran Suzuki was willing to give up so much, and ultimately he put him over as well. So, you know, it was really good outing for Page, all things considered.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen Minoru Suzuki like shut people down when he didn't want to do anything. I mean, Minoru Suzuki is generally speaking a very generous wrestler. It doesn't look like that, but if you watch his matches, he gives people an awful lot of stuff because he understands the business. You know, I'm 50 years old, someone else has to come up, I have to have people to wrestle, I have to make them look good before I look good, you know, otherwise I've beaten nobody. So, you know, he's a genuinely generous wrestler, and he he does enjoy, I just genuinely think he enjoys wrestling that much that he wants more people to enjoy it, even though he's a bad guy and a heel, and he thoroughly enjoys peeping people up for a living. That's why he does wrestling, as he said in the past. But, you know, I think he genuinely does want to see young stars get developed, and wrestling's given him an awfully good life, and he wants to bring back, put that back into the business.
As it should be, and it's just a shame that some veterans or established stars don't share that philosophy, but it is what it is.
Indeed. Next matchup was Jay White versus Togi Makabe, 10 minutes and 22 seconds. I actually really enjoyed this one. I think Togi's got better and better, like fine wine through this tournament. And for some reason, this match clicked with me that Jay and Togi were made for each other. And you on paper, you wouldn't think that, would you? But it was just like the way that they linked things together, and Togi was still lumpy, but good. But it all worked together for me, and I kind of enjoyed this match. I've got a feeling you're not going to enjoy it as much, though.
No, surprisingly, I actually enjoyed it a little bit more than the previous contest. Yeah. So even though I was giving Jay a bit of a hard time just then, on this particular night, I thought this match was slightly the better one. But I have to caveat it by giving more of the credit to Makabe. Sorry.
That's okay.
Jay White fans. again, technically, Jay, he's a very good worker, but he just doesn't connect with me. The stuff he does as a heel still feels like, okay, I've got to do a heel thing wrong, feeling like something that's spontaneous and feels authentic and real. And as I mentioned last time I was on the pod, I think that will come with time. He is a young guy. He's somebody as a heel character who's only a year in, or less than a year into this. So it will come. But, he's somebody that I'm struggling to connect with just at this stage. But just as on a standalone basis, I actually quite enjoyed the match. I thought, it was good fun, good back and forth. One of Makabe's top three or four matches, actually. I thought his opening night match against, I think it was Yoshihashi memory, was really, really good. I think that's still my favourite Makabe match of the tournament thus far, but this wasn't actually that far off.
No, it was. I really genuinely enjoyed it. I'm not a biggest Togi Makabe fan, but this, I think, just the way that Jay works, the way that Togi works, and it like left space for Togi to do his stuff, and Jay was able to be a dick, and it worked the way it should work. A heel and face should work. And I think if you married Jay and Togi up for a 3-month run, Jay would get a lot better at being a heel very quickly. I know they can't really do that, but it'd be nice if they could. I also think as well, it'd be really interesting to see what plans they had for Jay White originally, because originally he wasn't supposed to be Switchblade, from what rumors tell us. It was supposed to be Sami Callihan, and it wasn't, thank the Lord. not a Sami Callihan fan. Because of his performance in the World Tag League, where they decided, yeah, maybe not. So I'd be interested to see what they would have done with Jay White should he have actually just come back as a straight babyface back off Excursion. That would have been interesting.
Yeah, I think it's the right thing to push White, because he clearly is a very talented worker. But he's somebody I describe as a mechanic, and that he can assemble something that is actually really good. But beyond that, some of it is a bit too robotic for me. And there needs to be a bit more, in terms of character. And I think that he shows glimpses of it, but it's still a bit rough around the edges. And that's why I actually prefer Paige at the moment, because Paige is still a work in progress as well, of course. But as a heel, I kind of believe him. That he is a dick in more of a way than I do with White. I think White seems like this really nice kid who is playing the heel, and he can certainly watch some of the tapes from some of the great heels of the past, and just pick up those little nuances that made all the difference. And I think he will do that. He seems like he's committed to his craft, and 2-3 years from now, it won't even be a conversation, I'm sure of it.
Yeah, I mean, he's got the presence, and the entrance is right, and the moves he does in the matches are right, but it's not just that, is it? It's linking things together. You know, it's not. I mean, you look at Jake Roberts, he wasn't the best worker in the world from a moves point of view, but he knew how to put a match together and knew what to do to make you hate him more than anyone else ever, to make you scared of him, despite the fact he was a guy who was kind of skinny and kind of fat and kind of out of shape, but you were terrified of him.
No, absolutely, yeah. And that's why Jay just needs to work on, you know, the finer details. And it's those finer details that make all the difference. And it's the same with actors as well. You know, the better actors out there are those that can just hone in on those really, really fine details that make all the difference between a good performance and a great one. And I think once Jay cracks it, then, you know, he will be a real asset in this company.
Indeed. The next match was Hiroshi Tanahashi, who won in 16 minutes and 3 seconds. Got to say, Hiroshi Tanahashi's hair on this particular occasion was a fine feathered affair. That's all I've got to say about this match. What did you think of it, Mo?
I thought it was a really good performance by Tanahashi. One of his better ones in the tournament. He's actually had a really good tournament, actually. He's worked some consistently really good contests, and this was no different. You know, he's one of the best guys in the game when it comes to working a closing stretch, and you know, he pulled it out again here, and you know, picked up another 2 points, and well placed for block A now.
Indeed. Which gets us to the final now. Hiroshi Tanahashi's had a clean run, undefeated, 14 points. And the final match of this night was Kazuchika and Okada and Evil. Now, this was the match that kind of stole the tournament last year. Evil pulled out a surprise win, which set him up at King of Pro Wrestling, I think, or Destruction for the IWGP Heavyweight Championship match. Obviously, no championship shot on the line here, but Okada and Evil did have a cracking match. 18 minutes and 27 seconds. Again, not quite as good as the two previous matches from the previous night, but still a really, really good effort. I do like Evil a lot, and I think he goes under the radar an awful lot. I think that's partly because of his role within LIJ. Obviously, he's the number two to, well, he's kind of like the number two, the joint number two with Sanada to Naito. So it's an interesting kind of dynamic with him. I kind of see him as the Arn Anderson of LIJ. He's the guy who's, and kind of the Tomohiro Ishii in Chaos kind of deal. He's the guy who's second in command, who's never probably going to win the championship, but he's going to have some cracking matches and defend his honor better than anyone else in the group. And that's why I like seeing from Evil. And this kind of matched up this year, matched that up in this match. I'm not sure it was quite as good as last year's match between the two, but it certainly was a really fun match to watch. And Okada took a beating to start with and then slowly built everything together with all the Rainmaker variations he could manage and the swap moves, and he pulled out Everything is Evil, and Evil pulled out a Rainmaker. It's the kind of thing that only happens in the G1 in New Japan Pro Wrestling, having to steal each other's moves to get the job done. What did you think of it, Mo?
Oh, fantastic. Again, I agree. It was very slightly for me a notch below last year's match, which was amazing. But this in its own right was superb as well. And match of the night for me. Evil is somebody who I suggested last time I was on that could certainly be considered for possibly a run at the the IWGP. Not necessarily to become the champion, but, you know, they need to kind of keep things fresh. I mean, they can't go to the same five or six guys over and over for, you know, the title matches. And they will occasionally need to go with others, and Evil is certainly up there for me as one who could, you know, have a viable run at the title. And even if he falls short, you know, he can still come across as a credible challenger with the right kind of booking. And this match was an example of, you know, the fact that he can certainly deliver in those types of matches with the likes of Okada. So I really enjoy this, and, you know, some of the counters that they pulled out here were just breathtaking, and some of it is just so clever, the way that they can counter a counter almost. It's just very, very smart. What amazes me is that they can come up with really intricate matches like this, and then come up with something equally as intricate, if not more so, just one or two nights later in a tournament as high profile as this. So kudos to them, because, you know, you need to have a really good wrestling brain to keep coming up with know, such clever ideas that weave themselves into a match like this and turn it into something quite so terrific.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of that comes from Ghetto's kind of creative style. It is kind of like, I've got this idea for you to figure it out, as opposed to, you know, I hesitate to say the WWE kind of style, whereas, you know, you've got a writer who sets up a storyline, which means you've got to have a match, which a producer helps the wrestlers to design, and then you go have the match. It's a different kind of dynamic, you know, and kind of that's kind of happens in TV companies, obviously Lucha Underground, Impact Wrestling, and MLW as well. But this is a different dynamic of way of laying out matches, and that kind of puts that onus on the wrestlers. Back in the day, that was kind of like what would happen. You know, if you went to, I think Jim Ross was talking about it, like if you went to Mid-South, Bill Watts, who was the owner of Mid-South, would bring people in and give them the book. They, you know, the champion, the lead star or the lead heel would actually book the territory for a period of time. And Bill would help out, and no one ever did anything in Mid-South that Bill didn't agree with. But it was down to the creativity of the wrestlers to make the matches work and make the stories work and how they were going to get each other over to make the big payoff. And in this environment, that kind of thinking matches well with New Japan style. You know, they don't have TV. It's all pay-per-view. So you've got to make those matches work and tell those stories over a shorter period of time, because everything goes online. It's not even like WWE don't put house shows online. Well, New Japan put everything online. So you have to make every moment count. And the only way you can do that is to delegate responsibility to the people who are doing the stuff. And that's where New Japan, I think, is really making waves in the way the model of how wrestling is presented.
Oh, indeed. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's part of the reason why the talent that work in New Japan enjoy it so much. Because compared to the WWE, it's far less of a restrictive environment, and the talent have much more leeway, much more flexibility, much more freedom to express themselves. Whereas in the WWE, it's really quite the opposite, bar select few individuals who do get a bit more creative control. And I think that that's why we get such consistently good end product from New Japan Pro Wrestling, because you know the talent are allowed to go out there and enjoy what they do, whereas in the WWE you often hear about frustration amongst talent that they feel the environment is too restricted, they have to cut their promos in a certain way, and it's all produced for them by others, and then matches are laid out, and sometimes they have to put up a fight just to work certain spots into matches, which producers might not be too keen on. Whereas there's very much more, much less of all of that in this company. And that's why when people like Gallows and Anderson in WWE ever talk about New Japan, you know, their eyes just light up even now because they enjoyed it so much. If you ask AJ Styles, he'll say the same thing. You know, it's just such an immense environment to work in. And you know, Will Ospreay as well, you know, he had the opportunity on a couple of occasions to go to WWE, also to TNA, and you know, he decided actually a bit of Ring of Honor with New Japan being my primary promotion would be the way that I'd like to go. And if you asked him, he will tell you, you know, he doesn't regret it for a second. He's absolutely made up that he made this decision. And a lot of it is because of the environment that, you know, they fostered within this company of allowing the talent to express themselves in the way they do.
Yeah, there's also the moral argument as well. There are some wrestlers who just won't sign with WWE because of their political beliefs, because of, you know, various decisions that company's made. It really is now like, this is kind of, we're going off the track here a little bit, but you know, we're at the end of the show, we can go off the track. It really does seem like the New Japan it's been an entire movement over the last 10 years led by people like Colt Cabana and the Young Bucks, that you don't have to be in WWE to make a decent living, to make an impact, to make a cultural impression in the wrestling world. And I think we're starting to see that more and more, where people are just going, nah, I want to stay here. Kota Ibushi and Zack Sabre Jr. are two other people who, they tried the WWE way and it was okay for the people who like it, but that's not what they want to do.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And, you know, there are people that grew up and had the ambition from the ages of 5, 6, 7, 8 to become a WWE quote-unquote superstar. And if that's what they wanted to do and if that's what they've now achieved, then, you know, more power to them. But there are, as you say, others that, you know, that wasn't their ambition. It was just about becoming a pro wrestler and enjoying being a pro wrestler. And what I certainly am seeing is that, generally speaking, not in every case, those that are able to successfully ply their trade on the independents, such as the Young Bucks, can not so new anymore, can, or not so young anymore, but
no,
they're able to go out there and express themselves, enjoy what they do, and still commercially have success as well. And the way that the business has changed means that, you know, increasing numbers of talent are able to go out there and enjoy what they do on the independents and still make a decent living as well. And in some cases, make more than a decent living, in fact, make quite a lot of money. You know, you ask Cody Rhodes, he will tell you as well, you know, he's probably making more now than he was in the WWE. Hmm. So they are, you know, setting that path for others to show that there isn't only one way to have success, and getting to the WWE and having a career there isn't the only way that you can define success. There are plenty of other ways, in fact, and that's why I'm glad that, you know, there are those out there that reject that way and say that, look, you know, we can have a very, very good career, a very lucrative career working in companies such as New Japan or even others, and enjoy what we do immensely and not have the pressure, not have the ultimate ball ache of dealing with the politics,
yeah,
and all the restrictions that come with being a WWE star.
I mean, I think the prime example for me is Grado. I mean, you look at a guy like Grado, and to say he would be a full-time professional wrestler, one of the biggest names in the European industry, even 5 years ago, people would have laughed you out of the building. Like, but last weekend, he comes out of the SECC and he gets the biggest pop of the night. A ludicrous pop. And, you know, he's on TV for World of Sport. He's on TV for Impact Wrestling. And he's wrestling as many nights of the week as he wants to wrestle. And, you know, the fact that the industry has got to that place, then me and you both know that the European industry was nowhere near that place even 4 or 5 years ago is quite ridiculous.
Oh, it is, absolutely. And, you know, that's why it's good to see the business in the States. And, you know, that's why I'm always a little bit suspicious about some of the things that are going on with, you know, WWE UK, NXT UK, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And the motives behind that and how it always seems to kind of pick up in terms of activity whenever the World of Sport concept starts to gather ahead of steam and start to get back onto ITV. And, you know, if it doesn't extend beyond this initial 10 episode series, what will that mean for WWE's activities in the UK? Will we no longer see, you know, more UK tapings and things like that? So, you know, that sort of thing is a worry. But certainly, it's really heartening to see that so many companies out there, in increasing numbers of talent, are able to do commercially reasonably well, relatively speaking, that allows people to make a decent living without the WWE being the be-all and end-all.
Indeed. Right, well, that brings us to the end of our show today. We're covering the G1 Climax, G1 28. Thank you very much for your time, sir.
Welcome. Well, a pleasure as always, I should say. I was really, really delighted to be on and to talk about that amazing match, Ishii against Omega. That was just sublime. So thank you for the opportunity to talk about it again.
No worries, mate. No worries at all. And if you watch any match from the G1 Climax, you have to watch that match. You have to watch that match. Seriously, find it. Anywho, you can find Mo at Mo Chatra on Twitter. Have you got anything else you'd like to plug at the moment, sir?
No, I think that's about it. I do a lot of other podcasts, which are non-wrestling variety, but No, I mean, in terms of the wrestling stuff, I should have another article out for the Daily Mirror next week, just recapping on the G1, unless somebody, one of the other writers beats me to it, but as far as I'm aware, I should still be on to do that, and looking forward to recapping what, as I mentioned at the start of the show, is shaping up to be the best G1 ever, and therefore the best wrestling tournament in history.
Just think about that, though. Like, when we were growing up as wrestling fans, the fact that the Daily Mirror covers the G1 is a thing of beauty, isn't it?
Oh, completely, yeah. I mean, it was just unimaginable. You know, even a few years ago, even obviously, the likes of the Mirror and other papers that weren't even dignified with...
lesser publications.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I have been covering the pro wrestling business for a number of years, but you know, for any mainstream title to be covering Japanese wrestling is something that I would never imagine. So it's really, really good that the likes of the Mirror were able to dedicate coverage to you know, the G1, and it deserves it because it is just an amazing tournament put on by an amazing company.
If anyone at The Guardian wants a wrestling writer, I'm quite happy. I'm free. I would do that. Anyway.
There you go. I'll be
listening. The Guardian. Brilliant paper. I love that paper. It's awesome. I read it all the time. Anywho, thank you very much, Mo. And we will be back soon with more coverage of the G1. We've only got not long left now. We're soon going to be at the final. We're going to be at Budokan Hall and seeing if Kota Ibushi flies off something really high and gets banned again. but we'll see. Thank you very much for listening today. You can find me at Sheriff Lone Star, and you can find the show at Troopany Show on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook, The Troopany Show, find out what we're up to. And you can also find us on Patreon, where you can keep The Troopany Show free forever for anyone. If you do want to sponsor The Troopany Show and help us cover some costs, that would be lovely. You can find us on those social media sites or email us at thetroopanyshow@gmail.com. Thank you very much for your time today. Thank you very much for listening. And we will be back soon. Take care. Bye.